When you need mealtime inspiration, it's worth shopping Kroger, where you'll find over 30,000 mouthwatering choices that excite your inner foodie. And no matter what tasty choice you make, you'll enjoy our everyday low prices, plus extra ways to save, like digital coupons worth over $600 each week. You can also save up to $1 off per gallon at the pump with fuel points. More savings and more inspiring flavors make shopping Kroger worth it every time. Kroger, fresh for everyone. Fuel restrictions apply.
Hello and welcome to The Price of Football, the show that looks at the money behind the beautiful game with me, Kevin Day, and Liverpool University's Kieran Maguire. Later in the show, we'll hear from Dale Vince, the chairman of Forest Green Rovers and owner of the electricity and energy company Ecotricity. First, Kieran, how are you? You had a lovely trip to Durham this week, I understand.
Yes, I was asked to speak to the Durham Union. I'm still not quite sure why they wanted to listen to somebody that teaches double entry bookkeeping for a living, but a gig's a gig. Really smart kids up there as well. I was very impressed.
Yeah. Durham University Union, Kieran, in case people are thinking you're some kind of coal mining union or old-fashioned 70s type union, you're going to say. Kieran, if you'll indulge me, I'd just like to share a small message with our listeners. It is about football finance, so I think it's pertinent. As you know, we recorded Monday's edition of the show on Saturday because you had to spend the whole of Sunday going to Leicester via Plymouth so you could get a decent price ticket. And I had to spend the whole of Sunday in a pub and then being infuriated by the worst refereeing performance I can remember at any game of football. So my message to fans is if anybody has the home phone number of referee Kevin Friend, I will pay for it. Because he needs a full and independent assessment of his opinion. So it is football finance, Kieran, because I am asking for the phone number of a referee in order not to intimidate him, Kieran, but maybe just to point out the error of his ways. Because the fact that he gets paid for doing that, and the fact that I know, at least one commentator, I think it was on the radio, apparently, was reported saying it's amazing that even though they were losing 3-1, Palace fans stayed behind to support their team. They didn't. They stayed behind to shout abuse at the referee as he left the pitch. It's what they stayed behind. It was astonishing, Kieran. But having got that off my chest, and I'm only going to half promise not to mention it again in the rest of the pod or do the rest of the season. Let's go. It's Newsday, Kieran. We were hoping to have positive news for Derby fans and joyful news for Derby fans. I don't think we have either, but on the other hand, I don't think we've got more bad news either, have we?
No, I don't think so. I've just been on a 2-hour live show on Radio Derby with some people from supporters groups and so on. And they were saying that there is the possibility on Thursday of an announcement from the administrators. They are looking forward to that. This weekend, they are hosting Birmingham City. And it's going to be, I think if people have read things from the EFL, perhaps they might have read too much. There's a genuine fear that the club might not be in existence on the 1st of February. I don't think that's the case. They did sell one of their youth players, Dylan Williams, this week for around about $400,000. So that will give the administrators money to pay the next set of costs going out. The EFL don't want to close Derby down unless it's worst case scenario. And I don't think we're quite there yet. So I think this weekend's match, Birmingham are unhappy with their owners. Derby fans are unhappy with a lot of issues present. Yeah. So I think it will be a crackling atmosphere, but I think both sets of fans will be potentially singing the same songs at times.
Yeah, we saw the anger of Birmingham fans at their game on Saturday when they marched around the pitch. We're recording this on Wednesday night, Kieran, quite late on, because of your appearance on Radio Derby. Last night, Sky were reporting that today was what they kept calling D-Day, I don't know whether they thought they were being clever because Derby starts with a D, and so does Day, which is why D-Day was called D-Day. But a little historical nugget of information for you there. I was never more ashamed to be called Kevin than I was on Sunday afternoon, I have to say, Kieran. But why did Sky have it in their mind that it seemed to me that they were expecting some kind of doomsday, D-Day announcement from the EFL today? And what are I hate to even ask you this question, Kieran. I genuinely hate to ask you this question because I know that there are so many Derby fans listening to us in the hope of getting some unbiased information. What are the circumstances, the parameters now by which the EFL reluctantly or otherwise would not allow Derby to continue as a club for the rest of the season?
Well, if the administrators go to the EFL and say, we've done our level best, but we do not think we have sufficient money to run the club for the rest of the season, then we've got a crisis.
Right.
But the fact that they've sold Dylan Williams, I'm sure there will be, it's the 26th of January today. Could they sell other players before the end of the month, which could generate enough money for them to see out the season? Then we've got until May to sort things out. It's a case of doing things to buy time, and that's what you're always trying to do in administration as an insolvency practitioner. You know that the sands of time are against you, so therefore you try to sell stuff to pay the bills, and you try to cut the costs. The administrators, I think, in my opinion, and it's just an opinion, I think they could possibly have done more with regards to those. Whether that would have resulted in the club earning fewer points, I can see that is their counter argument. I'm still quietly confident that there will be a positive resolution. The fact that we have three bidding groups is good. The fact that one has effectively outed themselves and said that they've made an indicative bid, 28 million, effectively sets a marker for the other two interested parties to know that that's now the de minimis. And therefore, if either the Appleby group or the Mike Ashley group want Derby a lot, then they're going to have to ask, then they will have to bid more money.
And many people, of course, saying, Kieran, that the next possible crisis is when the players have to be paid, which I don't slightly understand. A, I presume players can agree to defer their wages if necessary, but not all players surely are paid on the same day, are they? It's not like a company or the NHS where everyone's paid on the last day of the month or the first day of the month, is it?
I think there is a monthly payroll run, so
right.
There is a big cash commitment, but that's another option for the administrators. It's to get around the table with the players and say, if you agree to a deferment of wages, you will be football creditors, so therefore you will get the money. But again, cash flow is critical, and it pushes back in terms of timing. Some of those players are not on a lot of money. The kids that have come through the academy and so on might be on not particularly lucrative contracts. Some other players could probably take a hit for 2 or 3 months, and they'd have the eternal gratitude and legend status amongst Derby fans if they took that approach, and it allowed the club to continue to trade for the remainder of the season, which, again, I'm quietly confident about.
Good. Normally, I have to say, Derby fans who are listening to this, Kieran's instincts are usually spot on, so that is good news for you. Other news stories, Kieran, and the first one is almost beyond bizarre. FIFA president Gianni Infantino has come up with a very novel, is the only way I can describe it, reason for why there should be a World Cup every 2 years.
Yeah, I think this is one of the most obscene things I've seen in relation to football for an awful long time.
I was going to say tasteless, Kieran, but I think you've probably hit the nail on the head.
Yeah, what he's tried to do is to have some form of equivalence of the creation of a biennial World Cup, and the additional money that that would generate, which FIFA could then distribute to its members. And all of FIFA's decisions are driven by money. And that, I'm not saying that's right or wrong, but let's not try to dress it up as something else. Infantino has come out and said it could help African migrants from, I quote, death in the sea. One can only presume fewer people trying to cross the Med from Africa to Europe. I don't see the link myself, directly or indirectly. And if Mr. Infantino was so concerned about the livelihood of people, then I think there are certain issues in relation to the World Cup for the last two, or the event taking place later this year, and also what's happened in Russia. In terms of, we are aware that there have been problems in the construction of some of their stadia, and people have lost lives as a result. So he seems to want to be Mother Teresa when it suits him, and he wants to be a politician and diplomat when it suits him as well.
But it's also this, if he was saying, we'll have a World Cup every 2 years, and I'll tell you what we'll do, we'll have it in third world countries, because that's a way of helping those countries infrastructure-wise, economy-wise. But to imply that these desperate people have two choices, one of which is to risk death by paying everything they've got to evil, evil people to take their chances on crossing the sea to this country. But the other is to take a job for peanuts on a construction site. We don't know him. People who do know him may say, no, he means well, his heart's in the right place. But it's a very bizarre statement, and it doesn't reflect well on football, full stop, unfortunately, Kieran.
Yeah. And also, in respect of World Cups, they lose money for the host country.
Yeah.
We saw that in Brazil. We saw South that Africa, in South Africa.
Yes, absolutely.
Germany was different in, 2006? Because Germany already had the infrastructure.
Yeah.
So therefore, it didn't have to go and spend a lot of money on expanding stadia and so on. It's bizarre. It's a proxy war between FIFA and UEFA. Now, by all means, have a squabble, but for heaven's sake, don't bring people's lives and the issue of migration and what's happening there into it. It's they're completely disconnected.
Yes, of course they are. And talking of UEFA, they expect the rights income for the new look Champions League to rise to more than £4 billion.
Yes. So what UEFA did, I think this was partially being pushed by clubs before Super League was announced and certainly accelerated following the announcement of Super League, was to find some new agencies to go out and to sell the TV rights and to sell sponsorships and so on. And for people that are might not be familiar with the new format of the Champions League, this is something which clearly no fans have been consulted about. It's more matches taking place in what's known as the Swiss model, where I think you now have 36 teams that play 5 home games and 5 away games. And the opposition is decided by some form of draw. And then you go through to a round of 16 and so on. So the benefits for the club, if we take a look at Liverpool, for example, in 2019, when they won the Champions League, they made around about £100 million in prize money from UEFA. That's likely to go up by 40%, so that the winners will be getting somewhere in the region of £140 to £150 million from TV money. They will also have 2 extra home games for a club like Liverpool, probably making around about £3 million per home fixture. They will be getting extra money from sponsors because they will be in broadcast more often. So it will be very lucrative for those clubs that do qualify for the Champions League. If we end up with an embedded set of four or five clubs that are doing every year, that the disconnect between the rich and the not so rich, which is already huge in the Premier League, is going to be amplified further. And the glass ceiling, which exists in football, and again, you know, we started off talking about Derby. Well, you and I are both old enough to remember Derby County winning the old First Division, Derby County doing fantastically well in Europe, and they were followed by Forest and Villa and Everton, and we've seen Blackburn and Leeds United, and all of these clubs who have won the old First Division in merit. The trouble with this extra money being concentrated in the hands of fewer and fewer clubs is that we are heading for the Bayern Munichation of English football, in the sense that it's going to be, you know, one from three every year. You know, I appreciate in Germany it's one from one every year, and that's taking away some of the magic of the Premier League. The reason why it's so successful globally is that there is an element of sporting merit and chance in it.
Yes, and that glass ceiling you talk about in the Premier League is much harder to break through when you've got Kevin Friend on the other side of it polishing it for Liverpool. Although I have to say, Kieran, Kevin Friend might be a terrible referee. Jordan Henderson, on the other hand, very good ref. He was exceptionally good with his decision-making on Sunday and communicated it to Kevin Friend very well. Now, we've had several Manchester United fans, Kieran, suggesting to us that perhaps we could distinguish at times between Manchester United and the Glazers. Now, I understand that because, you know, many United fans are uneasy about the Glazers and what they do. But Manchester United, a.k.a. the Glazers, have just published their latest accounts. What do they tell us?
Yeah, so the way that Manchester United works is, remember, the club is registered in the Cayman Islands.
Yeah.
It is traded in New York and it is majority owned in Florida. And I think you have to separate out United PLC.
Sorry, Kieran, could you just explain that? Majority owned in Florida. That's a phrase I've not heard you use before. What does
that's the Glazer family.
Oh, I see. Right. Okay. I've got you. Yeah.
So you have to separate that out from proper Reds. And you know, I played for Trafford Cricket Club for 30 years, and so I shared a dressing room. And it was half red, half blue, and me.
although I imagine both sides were united in agreeing that you were a soft southerner, Kieran, I imagine.
Oh, yeah. Soft southern shite. That was my nickname amongst many.
Nicknames are supposed to be short and snappy, Kieran.
SSS, what are you doing?
Carry on.
And you know, United's core fan base is absolutely fantastic, and also some of the Manchester United fanzines are written passionately, wittily, forensically, commenting upon their club, and that's how fanzines should be. And for all those Manchester United fans, I've got nothing but respect. So separate the fans from the owners.
I also have to say, Kieran, again, I'm sorry for interrupting you again, that In my role as a broadcaster, whenever I visited Manchester United Football Club, I've been treated very well by the staff at Man United. Yeah. The people that work at the club are very decent people, in my experience.
Yeah, they are, because they're local lads.
Yeah, and lasses, yeah.
Yeah, absolutely. And my mate Dodgy Pete Brooks, he's one of the chief stewards there, and you couldn't meet a nicer guy. And he's quite legendary. You might remember this from growing up in the 70s. And there was a picture of a Manchester United fan, I think it was at Elland Road, with a dart in his eye. Right? That's Dodgy Pete Brooks, and who I shared a dressing room. I played cricket with Pete at Trafford.
Did they call him Dodgy Pete because he didn't dodge?
his running, his calling of singles was quite legendary. So, but don't if Dodgy Pete calls you for a quick one, don't.
I've often used that as a guide in life, Kieran. Anybody calling me for a quick one has quite often led me into weekends full of trouble.
So Manchester United did publish their accounts in the USA about 6 months ago, or 5 or 6 months ago. And so we did pick up most of the figures, but American rules are different from UK rules. So therefore, we can go into the UK accounts and pick out a few things that they don't show in the States. And I think perhaps some of the stuff that United fans might feel slightly bridling about was Ed Woodward got a £2.9 million salary in his final year of the club. Remember the year in which he was behind Super League, you know, and he's trying to distance himself from that now. But I don't think that's held. That holds a lot of water with proper Reds. So United did lose money, but that was on the back of COVID. They lost 38 million. Another interesting thing was that Manchester United's women's team, their results came out, and United's women's team lost money, but I think they are now pretty close to having one of the biggest wage bills in the WSL. Their wage bill went up 40%. And I think United are certainly attracting players. They're competing fiercely this season for the title. So their women's team has done extremely well, considering it was only set up 3 or 4 years ago.
Talking of the Super League, producer Guy, in a fit of enthusiasm, sent the questions in for our next pod today for some reason. Ooh. I think he thought maybe if he gave me an extra day's notice, I might actually do some proper research. I don't know. He thought wrong. but there's a very interesting question in there about the creation of an African Super League, which I'm looking forward to hearing you talk about in terms of our own Super League, the Premier League. Clubs are set to lose millions in television revenue as a result of their insistence on postponing matches due to COVID outbreaks and injury crises.
Yes, so clearly it's been quite a sensitive issue in terms of how matches have been called off at short notice. Yeah. There have been subtle and not so subtle accusations of clubs gaming the system, perhaps Arsenal. waiting for yeah. players Arsenal. To return yeah. from AFCON. they might have some injuries, and also the inconsistency is that you've got, you know, for example, Arsenal sent a player out on loan to Middlesbrough, and then a couple of days later, a match is called off due to not being able to raise a team. So I think there have been eyebrows raised, but this has cheesed off the broadcasters, because a lot of the matches were quite high profile, and those matches are being rescheduled. So Amazon pay their money to the Premier League because the two slots that they get are perfect for Amazon's ambition of getting people to sign up for Amazon Prime. So you can effectively have a 30-day trial. The first set of fixtures takes place a couple of weeks before Christmas. Then you've got the fixtures between Christmas and New Year. They work really well for Amazon Prime because people get a bit bored. They go on it. They get seduced by the ecosystem of Amazon Prime, and you know it does deliver stuff very quickly, and it's a very comprehensive set of things that you can buy there, and therefore you get locked in customers. So that works really well for Amazon. If some of those matches are postponed, and therefore they get rescheduled for January, February, March, that doesn't work for Amazon. So you know, they are not particularly happy. I think BT Sport have suffered disproportionately because they had some midweek fixtures as well, which were hit fairly hard. What can the Premier League do? It can go down a variety of routes. A, it can say, okay, we are unable to supply what we had committed to in terms of the contract, and we'll give you a refund, or they can try to offer additional matches later in the year. We'll have to wait to see how the broadcasters respond. I think the senior broadcasters, and in that I mean BT Sport and Sky, they were pretty sanguine when this originally happened as a result of the lockdown a couple of years ago. They ultimately wanted a Premier League product to be able to show. So they did take a rebate, but that rebate's being spread over 3 or 4 years. Whether the broadcasters are going to be as generous when the reasons behind some of these postponements have not really been entirely clear, is yet to be determined.
Yeah, I believe we discussed this at a time, and it was very early on in our podcast career, Kieran. We barely knew each other at the time, and I'd only just discovered you were a Brighton fan, so I was a bit sulky. But Amazon's first round of matches were in at the end of 2019, and I worked on a TV show they did leading up to it with Gabby Logan, Peter Crouch and John Bishop. And Amazon execs that I got friendly with were quite open about the fact that their model relied on people subscribing to Amazon Prime or taking the free 30-day trial in order to watch games and then forgetting to cancel it, essentially. And I think the number they talked about was as many as 80% of people who took the free trial then didn't cancel it and ended up paying. So I can understand why Amazon would be particularly unhappy about losing the games. And as well, some of them, the Arsenal-Liverpool League Cup game, for example, was cancelled at less than a day's notice. And Sky were visibly unhappy when they were announcing that that game wasn't going on. But you could also argue that part of the problem, Kieran, over the winter holidays, the Christmas holidays, is that partly due to broadcasting, clubs are forced to play so many matches that it's not surprising their players are struggling.
Yes. You know, we have come from a short summer break. Matches are being concentrated into a shorter period of time. We've got next season. I think next season starts on the 31st of July.
Yep.
Because of the World Cup.
Yep.
So there's no sympathy, I think, from fans in terms of, you know, players earn a lot of money, therefore they should be able to play. But if the players have got, if players end up with soft muscle injuries, you can't play. You can't play with a knackered hamstring, you know, regardless of how much you're paid. So, yeah, I mean, I love football. I become footballed out at times.
Yeah.
And, you know, when it's people like us who are pretty hardcore, thinking, I just really can't be that arsed anymore. You've got to wonder whether we've got the balance quite right.
Yeah, I imagine when you were in those Manchester dressing rooms, they thought all your muscles were soft, I imagine. This episode of The Price of Football is brought to you by Pact Coffee. Big coffee is bad coffee, full of underpaid farmers and low-quality over-roasted beans, all of which just leaves a bad taste in the mouth. Pact is changing the coffee industry from the grounds up.
From paying a price that's more than fair to knowing farmers on a first-name basis, Pact builds long-term relationships that flourish, putting the needs of their partners first and providing coffee that's personal to their customers. With Pact, you'll get award-winning specialty coffee, freshly roasted to perfection for your order, and ground just moments before it's shipped. There's over 15 different coffees on the menu at any given time to choose from, including Great Taste 2020 and 2021 winners.
So make a pact to make better coffee now. Price of Football listeners can get a free brewing kit with their first order. So go to pactcoffee.com, that's pactcoffee.com, and enter the code POF at the checkout when you sign up for a Pact Coffee plan to create your flexible coffee subscription and get that free brewing kit. Make a pact to make better coffee. Better for the farmer, better for the consumer, better for the planet.
I'm Steve Lamack, and every week I'm joined by Music Allies Head of Insight, Stuart Dredge, on The Price of Music, the weekly podcast all about the money behind the music industry. In each episode, we discuss the very latest goings-on in the music business and dig into the finances behind the big stories.
So whether you're a music lover who just wants to know more about what really goes on in the industry, or you're an aspiring musician, manager or label owner who wants some inside knowledge on how Spotify's financial model really works, or what the future holds for independent live music venues, this is a show for you.
Subscribe to The Price of Music in your podcast app now. See you soon.
Now, we've talked quite a lot about cryptocurrency, Kieran, recently on the pod, and I have to admit I still don't fully understand the concept. So last week we spoke to Peter McCormack, who's a Bitcoin disciple and the new owner of Bedford FC. And did, in fact, because you suggested he might like to enjoy a proper working-class football experience along with his American cameraman, did turn up in the Porson's Arms before the Liverpool game on Sunday, beg your pardon, with his American cameraman, which caused some consternation because there are people in that pub who don't like to be filmed under most circumstances, especially when they're sitting in the back of the Porson's Arms. But it was very interesting, though, because a lot of, as you know, you've met, you know, there are about 30 people. I know everybody in that pub,
yeah,
by you know, name or recognition, but there's about 30 of them who have been friends for a long, long time. And six or seven of them were very aware of Peter and were very interested in Bitcoin. And he went some way to explain it. And what he was passionate about in particular was that Bitcoin is the only cryptocurrency that has value or merit, and that's illustrated. This is a very long-winded way of saying that one of sport's biggest cryptocurrency-based platforms has gone into liquidation this week.
Yes, this is a company called Iqonix. So they always have these strange names, Iqonix, and It had deals with some big players in football. So it had a deal with La Liga, with McLaren Formula One. It was also supposed to be Palace's sleeve sponsor.
It was,
and Palace have now taken out legal action against Iqonix because they didn't pay on the due dates.
Yeah.
So I think it is showing the perils in relation to some of these currencies. And I was looking at an article which said 1,000 cryptocurrencies have come and gone. Mm-hmm. So, you know, Bitcoin is by far the highest profile one. You know, Peter McCormack himself said it's the only one that he deals with. And he views it as an alternative payment platform. And, you know, I've said all along, you know, I send money across to my mum because my mum lives in a little village in Ireland.
Yeah.
And it costs me, I think it costs me 30 quid every time.
Yeah.
And I'm going, well, you know, I'd rather that 30 quid goes to my mum. But, yeah, you know, why am I having to pay a bank? Because how much effort does the bank put into doing this?
Yeah.
And it's all automated. And yet the banks do make an awful lot of money from payment platforms themselves, which has created unhappiness and as partially has been a contributory factor to cryptocurrencies and alternative. It's a lot cheaper way of transferring some form of payment to somebody else, and as that, I think it's great. Yeah, you know, I think it's fine, provided you've got some form of security and some form of faith in the system. All of these other all of these sort of new kids on the block, they seem to have just been set up as a vehicle to make a quick buck, and there is a danger of them going out of business. We've also seen in relation to cryptocurrency and the NFTs, these sort of digital pictures which you pay money for. Yeah. John Terry and Ashley Cole look like they're going to be up on some form of rap because they've been promoting these products, which have likenesses to the Premier League trophy. Now, we've spoken on many occasions about intellectual property. Well, you can't use, or you can't pretend to use the Premier League trophy as a vehicle to sell your own products.
Yeah.
So, you know, it's messy, and my reservations, which are always the same three, it's unregulated, it's volatile, and it's open to manipulation. They stand, and unfortunately, the people that have used Iqonix, who have perhaps bought NFTs, are now finding out that they are completely worthless, and it needs some organization to step in to give some sort of kike mark. But given the somewhat rebellious nature of the cryptocurrency market, of course they don't want regulation, because that would be you know, handing across power to some form of an establishment.
Two questions, Kieran. I hesitate to say this because Kevin Friend was the worst thing that happened to Palace this weekend, but this is an embarrassing story for my club because there was a big fanfare when Palace announced their relationship, their partnership with Iconics. First of all, why has it gone into liquidation? And secondly, why does it appear that Bitcoin is the safest and most credible of the cryptocurrencies?
Well, in terms of Iconics, companies go into liquidation because they spend more money than they generate. That's right, as simple as that. So what you've got to ask yourself is, well, what's the money being spent on? And Iconics had, you know, say, deals with La Liga. It signed a three-year sponsorship deal with Essex County Cricket Club in 2021. So money potentially was going out to the institutions which they were sponsoring. And why are they trying to constantly align themselves with sports clubs? It's because the thing is, Crystal Palace is a trusted brand. Essex County Cricket Club, trusted brand. La Liga, you know, they are held in high regard by the fan base. So you know, it's not because they love football or cricket. You know, I can't make that. You know, I really think that's absolutely critical to get across.
Yeah.
So, they go bust. And in terms of your second question, I think Bitcoin is in a similar position to Amazon in that it was first out of the block,
right,
and therefore it allowed itself to build a certain size. And you do become a dominant party in the market, and that allows you to have a bit more credibility, because when people talking about if I was to say to somebody, do you want to invest in a cryptocurrency, and if so, which one, they would say the first answer might be, I'm not certain. But if I was going to invest in one, Bitcoin's the one I've heard of. So it's a bit like when you know, IBM used to sell their computers. You buy from IBM because you've heard of IBM.
Right, okay. I'm sorry, Kieran. This is one of the reasons our relationship is so strong, because you're so patient with me. If I was investing in Bitcoin, how do I make a return on my investment? That's what I struggle to understand. Is I understand there's an exchange rate, because Peter McCormack was very good. He explained all that to me in the pub on Sunday, and he bought a round of drinks, which is obviously made him more popular with the Palace fans in the portions that didn't want to be filmed. Obviously, they drank the drink off camera, but you know, still a gesture was there. He explained to me that there is an exchange rate for cryptocurrency, if you like. But if I was to invest £1,000, which I haven't got, in cryptocurrency, how do I make money on that?
Right. Well, what would happen is, say for your £1,000, you will end up with 0.1 Bitcoin.
Right.
And that gets validated via this thing called blockchain, and you would have a wallet. And it's a digital wallet, and provided you know where it is on your computer, that 0.1 Bitcoin is yours forever. Now, if the price of Bitcoin goes up, your 0.1 Bitcoin, let's say the price of Bitcoin goes up from 10,000 to 15,000, your 0.1 Bitcoin goes up from £1,000 to £1,500. So that's how you make money. But what goes up can come down. And we've seen in recent days, where everybody's now a bit twitchy as to what's going to be happening in Ukraine, a lot of the markets have been hit. And also the cryptocurrencies have been hit, because what investors tend to do is that they tend to go for core things, you know, fundamental things at a time of a potential crisis.
Yeah, it's probably best for me not to get involved working on the basis that I had my digital season ticket in some kind of wallet on my phone, and I managed to lose that. I don't know how, but the club have had to send me 8 paper tickets for the last games of the season. I blamed Ali. She wasn't.
I thought you blamed Kevin Friend, to be fair.
Kevin Friend tampered with my phone. Well, one more news story, Kieran, before we go to our interview. And it's an interesting one, and I was slightly surprised to read this, but I trust producer guy implicitly, so much so, as you know, that I don't check anything he sends me. But Tottenham have had more empty seats than any other club in the Premier League this season. Is that just a corollary of the fact that they've now got many more seats to fill?
I think that is a contributory factor. I mean, this is a study by a, I think by a gambling website. So, you know, it's a glorified press release.
Right.
But according to this report, Spurs had an average of 8,000 empty seats per game. Now, when football clubs announce attendances, they actually announce pretendances, because they announce the number of seats sold rather than the physical number of people attending. You know, it says here that Spurs haven't had a crowd of more than 45,000 since December the 5th, which strikes me as...
Really?
I find that a bit difficult to believe, personally.
What, an actual crowd they're talking about?
Yeah, that appears to be the case, yes.
Well, that's... Okay.
And I know, I'll be honest, and by all means have a pop at us. You know, I went to a match at the Amex over Christmas, and it didn't look more than half full to me, because at 8 o'clock on Boxing Day... When the only way of getting to the ground is by train is an issue. So
well,
yeah, we are seeing
in the middle of a new pandemic as well. So
yeah,
because there's the Palace Norwich game on the 28th. I think there's I doubt if there are more than 18,000 people in there, but the official attendance was 24,000. Yes.
Yeah. So is this going to be a long-term issue for clubs? Are they genuinely losing money, or is it a case of, you know, season ticket holders just saying, I'll give it a swerve, in which case the club doesn't lose out. But of course, every club does sell tickets on a match day basis. Spurs has an international following. It's especially in Korea. It's because of Son. You know, he is incredibly popular over there. That particular tourist market has dried up because fans aren't traveling to the UK because of COVID factors. So whilst football has bounced back in many regards, I think this is indicative that we are not over COVID from a football perspective as yet.
Right. Interview time, Kieran. More and more people are interested in football's impact on the environment and how the game can become more sustainable. And, of course, the pioneer of all this was Dale Vince, who's the owner of Ecotricity and Forest Green Rovers. It's a story I'm particularly interested in because I reckon I'm probably currently contributing about £2,000 a year to the cause of sustainability at Forest Green Rovers through the fact that I get my power through Ecotricity, which I didn't know about until Ali told me when I said we were interviewing Dale Vince. That's how little I'm allowed to contribute to the household running. But we spoke to Dale Vince about sustainability and about Forest Green. Dale, thank you very much for joining us. Before we talk more about the remarkable story of Forest Green Rovers, tell us a little bit about your background and your commitment to sustainability. Was that always there, or did you have a kind of St. Paul on the road to Damascus moment?
Yeah, I guess I've been concerned about sustainability since I was a kid. When I left school, I kind of wandered around looking for kind of how it was that I wanted to live, realised I didn't want to live in towns in a conventional way, so I dropped out. And I spent 10 years living on the road in a variety of different vehicles, living off grid, mostly in Britain, but abroad as well for a year or so. And I learned a lot of life skills along the way. I dropped back in the early 90s when I was parked on a hill just outside Stroud and had the idea to build a big windmill. I was using a little windmill to power my trailer, so I had a familiarity with it. And I could see that it was just becoming possible. So my journey in business began then, about 1991.
Yeah, you know, I guess when you say you learned life skills, I think they're probably very different to the few life skills I have, Dale, at the time. So you find yourself in 2010, Forest Green, essentially a village team, that are in the conference but going bust. Did you buy them as an act of local generosity, or was the plan always to buy any club and make that the greenest in the world?
I never had a plan to buy a club or run a club, or even be a part of a club. I didn't buy Forest Green. I just took responsibility, which meant taking all of the debts and all of the problems, but I didn't buy them. And it was really because Forest Green was a big part of the local community. I could see that. I went and met the guys and watched the game. I thought they were lovely people. It was a lovely club. And been going since 1889. You know, it was 120 years at the time. And I thought, look, I could do this. It's in my backyard. So why not just do it?
Yeah, I believe from the research I did for my own, I believe they were started by Reverend Peach, which I think in the circumstances is probably a brilliant bit of nominative determinism. So when did the idea then, was it right from the start of you taking over the club that you thought we have to make this a sustainable project, or was this something that came to you when you started to get the club back on its feet?
It was something I bumped into straight away. So the whole thing was just a rescue mission. And I didn't give it a lot of thought in terms of, you know, where it might go, what it might involve or anything like that. And on day one, I bumped into the fact that we were serving red meat to the players in the way of beef lasagna. And I was horrified because that made me part of the meat trade and I couldn't have that. And that was just the first thing I bumped into. I think within a matter of days, couple of weeks, I realized that I would have to change just about everything about the club. And that actually there was a great opportunity to align it with the principles of my day job, which is at Ecotricity, where we focus on the three big issues of energy, transport, and food, because 80% of everybody's personal carbon footprint is wrapped up in those three things. And so we set about transforming the club into a modern, sustainable football club.
And were your own fans resistant at first? Because you're still, after all, based in a very rural community. And I'm sure some of those notions, your notions about meat, for example, weren't shared by quite a few of the people in the area.
Yeah, and we're going back 10 years, of course. You know, veganism and plant-based living is kind of more common, more acceptable, less exceptional today than it was back then. Back then, it was a little bit radical for sure. And yeah, there was some resistance. But, you know, I'm a fan of Star Trek, and my favorite Star Trek villains are the Borg. And you know what they say about resistance, don't you?
I'm going to get on to the way you deal with some away fans' resistance later on using humour, which always makes me laugh. But let me mention a few specific things that are happening inside the New Lawn Stadium. It's powered by 100% green energy, solar-powered lawnmower, you use rainwater to irrigate the pitch, you provide electric car charge points. These are all fairly simple things to do, yet many other clubs still seem to think they're too radical and too expensive.
Yeah, I mean, I think you've hit the nail on the head there. They are really simple things to do, all of them, actually, and they're not expensive, and a lot of them save you money anyway. It's much easier than most people think it is.
And Kieran, presumably, in terms of football finances, in the long run, it does become less and less expensive as the stadium gets more and more sustainable.
Yes, because it's an investment. And the great thing about taking a sustainable perspective is that the return on the investment goes on forever. Once you've made that initial commitment, you set up an irrigation area, then as long as we've still got rain coming down, and let's face it, with global warming, that's not guaranteed, but when that day arises, football probably isn't our first priority, then you've got something which is going to last forever.
And Dave, you plan to go even further because your ambition is to build the greenest football stadium in the world. Is that still happening, or has COVID finances delayed it?
Yeah, both of those are true. It's been delayed, not particularly by COVID finances, but the whole pandemic just slowed everything down. We're still going ahead. We started work this week, actually, on an archaeological dig on site because the southern end of the site has got a Roman villa underground. And we're about to build some training pitches, hopefully. Before we do that, we've got to have a comprehensive dig at the site to see what's there, really.
Oh, well, you've really piqued my interest now, because I was I studied archaeology at university for the 6 weeks I was there before I was thrown out. But it's one of my passions, so I'd love to know how that goes. We'll talk more about the sustainability in detail in a little moment, but the big problem, of course, now is that fans still have to travel from all over England to play at your ground. How can we reduce that impact? Would you be in favour of regionalising Leagues 1 and 2 to reduce the amount that people travel to games?
No, I wouldn't. I think that'd be a mistake. I think it'd be bad for football and bad for clubs. And I think that much is made of this issue of fan travel. And I think it's unwarranted, actually. You know,
we
go to an away game once every fortnight on average, don't we?
Yep.
We go to work every day. 10 days a fortnight, you know. I think the amount of fan travel involved in football is actually really small in the scheme of things. But football is often kind of held up by this, held to account for this. People say, oh, but that's the big problem, that, you know, that's the thing you can't solve, et cetera, et cetera. I don't think it's a big deal. But also at the same time, it's worth bearing in mind that the background is changing. Electric cars are taking over the roads now. Electric buses are just starting to hit the roads. In 10 years' time, there'll be electric planes. And so the mode of travel that we're taking at the moment is greening it up in the background.
Yeah. We know from social media and hilarious podcasts, of which there are many, that some of the away fans who go to your ground are a bit dubious about what's happening there, shall we say. But I like the fact, as we said before, that you acknowledge that through humour. I loved your April Fool's Day announcement that you were installing a meat scanner at the turnstiles. Is that a deliberate policy of humour, or have you just got some funny buggers working for you at the club?
Well, I just, it's my preferred way of dealing with adversity, probably. And, you know, just to stay humorous, not everybody is going to agree with everything that you want to do or everything that you say. I mean, that's life. So I'm pretty relaxed about that, you know. And I love some of the chants we hear from away fans that, you know, they make me laugh. And I just appreciate the banter of it, and I'm just unbothered by it. So, yeah, we have a laugh along the way.
Can you give us an example of some of those chants from the away fans?
Well, it's got a bit old now, but the first time I heard it, it made me laugh really loudly. We were at Tranmere, and one of our players went down, and Tranmere fans, we have a little bit of history with Tranmere, it's worth saying. One of Tranmere fans started singing, "Dirty vegan bastard, he's eating our grass." Made me laugh.
That's very funny. Why have you got issues with Tranmere?
Not issues, just a bit of history. We beat them at Wembley in a playoff final from the National League a few years ago. And then I think it was in the relegation year probably that it came to a bit of a head again. You know, they proposed this complicated formulae for calculating a points per game average based on the last 3 years' average or something, which would have saved them from relegation from League One to League Two. And we were just outspoken in saying we thought it was rubbish, and they didn't appreciate that.
And yet here you are, you find yourself, you're first in the table and they're second. And you're, I mean, this is a season to dream of, isn't it, at the moment?
Yeah, we play them next Saturday as well. So, oh, wow. Yeah, it's going to be fun.
Well, you've already alluded to the fact, Dale, that attitudes to plant-based eating, veganism, has changed a lot in the past decade. And we've talked a lot about fans, but what about players? I mean, there are increasingly more elite athletes like Lewis Hamilton who have adopted a vegan diet. But do you ever have to convince transfer targets that you won't be forcing lifestyle changes on them?
No, I think, you know, I think the players understand it. The players are pretty open to this kind of thing as well. You know, I mean, they're looking for any enhancements they can get from the world of sports science, and nutrition is a big part of that. We never find any issues with our players. In fact, the opposite. Every season, a handful of our players will embrace the diet themselves and take it home with them. So, I mean, the way it works is they're only vegan when we feed them, in effect. It just means that we only provide vegan food. What they do in their own time is up to them. They know that. But a bunch of our players every year feel the benefits of that food because we feed them like six times a week or something. And they take it into their lives proper. Same as our fans have, you know. They've come to the ground, tried the food, and loads of them have gone veggie and vegan. I mean, I'm being told by fans all of the time. It just never stops.
Well, that must be very heartening for you. It's clear, Dale, that despite the shameful efforts of some more reactionary elements of the media to denigrate the likes of Greta Thunberg, this message is getting through across the world and to young people in particular. And in football now, we've got certain groups like Football for Future. We've got UEFA's Cleaner Air, Better Game initiative. We have Brentford not replacing their kit next year for sustainability reasons. Is the message finally getting through to football, do you think?
Yeah, absolutely. It is. It's getting through to every walk of life. And I don't think football is any further behind or ahead of the curve than, you know, any other kind of area of life or business, if you like, you know. So these are important little steps. We've had a 2-year rolling cycle for our kit for a very long time now, which is what Brentford are talking about. It just makes sense, you know, not to encourage overconsumption is one of the little things that we can do.
What more has to be done, Dale, and what happens if we don't do it?
Well, we tend to focus on three big things. It's a lovely, simple message that can cut through for people. We focus on energy, transport, and food because 80% of our personal carbon footprints are in those three things: how we power our homes, how we travel, and what we eat. And we make decisions every day. We spend our money on things that either make the world go round the wrong way or could help it go round a better way, you know, a low carbon way. And at our club, we've demonstrated how we can do that as a football club. We have a trail of information for people that shows what we're doing in different parts of the club and why we're doing it. And then we hope that percolates through to them. And they're, you know, when they're back home, they think, well, you know, I could do this at home, actually. And they start to adopt bits and pieces of that. But the really important message here is that we have a lot of power in our own hands because 80% of the problems are caused by what we spend our money on.
Yeah, do you know what's interesting? My wife, she, yeah, Kieran will understand why, but my wife runs the household because I'm an idiot, essentially. But she was a very, very early adopter of Ecotricity. You supply all our power needs. But I found myself in the first year thinking, well, I'm probably doing enough now. I've got sustainable energy. And it was only after talking to my wife that I realized how much more I could do, but there isn't. I mean, I'm an intelligent middle-class person, and there are times when I have to be reminded that there are simple things I can do. It's like, just, you know, for some reason it becomes too much of a pain to put something in the right bin, especially late at night. But so there are so much more small individual things that we can do, that even though we don't see the effect, it's still very important that we do them, isn't it?
That's right, and it all makes a difference. And when millions of us do these little things, then it makes a bigger difference. I mean, that's a fact.
So here you are, Dale, final question, because I know we have time issues.
Is this the one I've never heard before?
Hopefully. I should be very disappointed if you have heard it.
So will I now.
You're 7 points clear, I believe, at the top of League Two.
With a game in hand. Goal difference to die for. Sorry about that.
Well, do you know what? That's one thing we've got. Palace have got this season, a goal. It does give you a little bit of breathing space, that one point extra for goal difference. Every goal that Newcastle scores is a dagger to my heart. You're top of League Two. If, in true Dr. Faustus style, Lucifer was to pop up and say, Dale, just put a bit of meat back in the burger and I'll get you in the Premier League in 5 years. Is there anything that would tempt you? Is there any way that somebody came in to offer you money to invest in the club, then they just said, we just want you to rein a little bit back on the green ideas, and if so, we can get you into the Championship, no. The Premier League?
No, not at all. And in fact, since the beginning of this journey, I was told that what we were doing would harm the club financially, we'd lose sponsors, people wouldn't come to games, all that kind of stuff, you know. And my answer at the time was, look, I didn't care. I wasn't going to do something that I didn't believe in purely for the sake of money. And that's our stance. You know, we won't take sponsors from the gambling industry, for example, obviously the meat industry. And, you know, we're the same at Ecotricity. We've got very clear ethical lines. We won't cross them for money. Absolutely not.
Which in a way means that you're successful already, doesn't it?
That's right. Cause we measure success differently.
Yeah. That's a brilliant way to end the interview on. Dale, thank you so much for your time. We know how difficult it was for you to fit us in. We really appreciate that. It's very kind of you.
No, my pleasure. Thank you.
He was really interesting, Kieran, I thought. There's a couple of things. I think sometimes what Dale Vince has done with sustainability overshadows the actual achievements of the football club, because it's based in a village called Nailsworth. It's possibly the smallest club or the club in the smallest village in the country. So it's remarkable that they're doing so well. But I was particularly interested in two things. Well, one I was scared of when he said that as a young man, when he went off grid, he learnt some life skills that have held him well, which I don't think he meant just skinning rabbits. I was quite intimidated by that.
Well, especially if he's a vegan.
Well, absolutely, yeah. Well, maybe that's why he's a vegan. I skinned a rabbit. Well, I was made to skin a rabbit at school. Long story, but
I once shot a rabbit.
Oh, Kieran.
Yeah, no.
Why?
Yeah, and well, it was sort of a bit annoying. Of rites of passage. We've got a farm in Tipperary, so I was marched out at the age of 9 with my old man with a rifle. Or with a shotgun, And he says, yeah, you got to learn how to shoot. And I'm going, I'm a lover, not a fighter. We came across and I started going, wasn't one of my greatest days. I've felt bad about it ever since.
I'm glad you felt bad. I mean, I know I'm a hypocrite here, Kieran, I'll happily eat them. But, you know, I'll eat Watership Down, but I won't shoot them. It's taken a darker twist than I thought in this interview. I was very interested, though, in his answer to the question about fans travelling, because I assumed, which you shouldn't do when you're interviewing people, that when we talked about cutting down the miles that fans travel to games by perhaps having a regional League One and League Two, he was very much against it.
Yes, he seemed to enjoy the idea of travelling up and down the country. But also, I'm thinking about it from a fan perspective. I go to away games as often as I can, and 90% of the time I'm travelling by train, which is a far more sustainable form of transport.
Fair point.
Yeah. So, I think as fans, we are pretty ingenious. And if you are travelling in car, you know, normally it'll be, well, I'll drive this time, and you get five of you in the car, and so on. So I think fans are conscious of this, not explicitly, but implicitly, because they want to save money, and alternatively, they want to have a few jars. So, you know, therefore they'll choose to travel using public transport, and also traveling home after a decent result on trains is a fantastic experience.
Yeah, indeed, that's true. Yeah. So I'm told. It's been a while. I had a very nice moment after interviewing Dale Vince when, because Ed, my son, is a big fan of Dale and his ethos. And Ed said to me afterwards, "It must have been strange, Dad, talking to the person who actually supplies your electricity and gas." I said, "I don't know why you think that's strange, Ed, because you're doing it right now." He's very interesting, and I would like to talk to him again, actually, because I think the idea of sustainability in football, it's slowly taking hold at other clubs, isn't it, Kieran? But as we discussed in the interview, it's not expensive to be sustainable.
No, because you've got to invest, we were talking about earlier about you getting a return on investment on your Bitcoin. Well, you can get a return on investment in terms of solar panels, water butts, recycling and so on very, very quickly. And with traditional carbon-based energy prices rising quite sharply, especially if Russia does get icy with the rest of us over the course of 2022 and beyond, then these things become even more cost efficient than they were before.
Yeah, we have a water butt, Kira, which is a fancy way of saying we've got a giant plastic barrel which collects rainwater and drain pipe off run. I'm not entirely sure how I'm saving the planet with it, as we don't do anything with it. And the cat's worked out how to jump up, knock the lid off, and drink the water, which is really annoying because I insist on supplying her with clean water every morning, which she won't drink, but she will happily drink out of that. And the fire pit that we bought for Christmas, which is now also covered in full of water. I make an effort, Kieran, but I'm just not very good at these things. If you'd like to make a small monthly contribution to the pod, that would be very kind of you. Please go to patreon.com/priceoffootball. Don't forget, our pod will always be free to air for everybody. And if you have a question you'd like answered on the show, please email us at questions@priceoffootball.com. Before we say goodbye, I shall hand you over to Mr. Kieran Maguire for his customary farewell.
Well, thank you again, everybody, for the feedback, for the messages and so on. We genuinely appreciate that you take the time to engage with us. If you want to use Patreon as a method of showing a bit of thanks, for as little as £1 a month, that can be done, and thank you very much for that. But if you just want to give us some positive vibes, if you just want to make us feel slightly more groovy in the charts when it comes to Apple and so on, and somehow we managed to reach number 9 in the Apple sports charts.
We did.
Earlier this week. We've got no idea how, but it's partly due to your reviews. When you go onto Apple or Spotify, whatever it's going to be, if you can give us a review, if you'd like to give us 5 stars, we'd be very grateful. And it doesn't matter what you say, by all accounts. You could say you would rather the show was hosted by Alan Brazil and Andrew Ridgeley. And the reason why I mentioned those two is that my book is somewhere in the Amazon sports charts, and I am behind Andrew Ridgeley and Alan Brazil immediately above me. So I thought, those would be pretty fantastic.
Yeah, I've got some Alan Brazil stories that we can't talk about on air, I have to say. And yes, Keir, we desperately need your good karma, but I suspect we're going to have less of it this week after you admitted to shooting Bugs Bunny in the face. Bye, everybody.
Bye. The price of football. Price of football.